This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today, I've got the distinct pleasure of having here in the studio with me the great Kenyan novelist Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who now is the Distinguished Professor of English in Comp Lit and Director of the International Center for Writing and Translation at the University of California, Irvine. Over his more than four decades of writing, Ngugi has been a journalist, a playwright, a lecturer, a novelist, of course, and a political prisoner. In the tradition of Frantz Fanon, Ngugi in 1986 wrote Decolonizing the Mind, The Politics of Language in African Literature, which stressed the importance of writing in the indigenous languages of Africa as opposed to English. Ngugi is the author of several novels, including A Grain of Wheat, Petals of Blood, and most recently, a very ambitious, delightful novel called Wizard of the Crow. Ngugi wa Thiong'o, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me how you got interested in being a writer.
Well, you know, first of all, I was born in Kenya into a large peasant family where, you know, the oral tradition was very strong. So we grew up, you know, listening to stories around the fireside. And then when I went to school, you know, I was really taken up with reading novels or any book of stories that came my way. So I encountered, you know, works by people like, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson, Treasure Island, you know, Dickens much later. And really, so it's a combination of storytelling by the fireside and reading books that really triggered my interest in writing.
When did you get the idea that you too could become a writer like a Dickens?
Actually, much later, when I went to university college in Uganda. It was called Makerere University College, which was then an affiliate of the University of London. This was in Kampala in 1962. Actually, my interest in writing, or rather my practice, actually started when I was in my second year.
When you were two?
At university. Mm-hmm. I was an undergraduate when I wrote my first two novels of The River Between and Weep Not Child.
And so writing came easily to you? Was it like a gift, or was it something you really had to work hard at?
Not as a gift. My remembrance of, my memory of every novel that I have written is that it has been a struggle. And finishing one, I always felt, would I have the strength and the power to write another one? So every one of them has been actually a struggle.
And this latest one, which is kind of monumental at more than 700 pages with all sorts of interlocking, delightful stories, Wizard of the Crow, how long did it take you to deal with this
one? Yeah, that one has took me about 8 years. I remember I started it in May 1997 in Orange, New Jersey, and did not finish it until I went to Orange County, you know, in California. So I keep on joking that it's a narrative which was written between two oranges, one east and the other one west.
It's the juice of two oranges. Uh-huh. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest is Ngugi wa Thiong'o, the great novelist whose most recent book is Wizard of the Crow. What are you trying to do in this book? Tell me in your own words.
Yeah, I was trying to look at a post-colonial dictatorship, particularly in 20th century, but also obviously partly 21st century. What happened, if you remember, last century, you know, particularly during the Cold War, you know, there were a series of dictatorships in Africa soon after independence. And my feeling was that those dictatorships were or sponsored by Western democracies in the struggle against the Cold War. So they became Western allies, if you like, you know. But they became, and although they were bred by indigenous conditions, in the end, they were not accountable to anybody, neither to the West, which sponsored them, nor to the people on whom they were, you know, actually imposed. So they became like the proverbial genie, which if you take it out of the bottle, you cannot return it back. So they became loose cannons, massacring their own people, and so on. So I was interested in the nature, in that historical dictatorship, but also in the nature of dictatorships.
And several of your books have dealt with this theme of the tragedy of, or the lost promise of post-colonialism. Why do you think independence didn't immediately yield more fruit?
Yeah, because I think, first of course, independence was a very progressive step, you know, in the history of Africa, very, very important, a very, very big achievement. But remember that the economic and political basis of anti-colonial struggles was empowerment of the African people, the empowerment of the working people of Africa. During the anti-colonial struggle, the nationalist bourgeoisie was actually allied to the people. After independence, they became allied to the Western, to the Western bourgeoisie. And that's really the problem, that they saw their power after independence as arising not from their alliance with the people, but with their alliance, you know, with the West. And so that disconnect was really a historical betrayal of the ordinary folk.
So this is of the middle class, or the
middle class,
class,
and allied with them.
The educated class, and the military, then.
Yeah, and the military, of course. The military, you see, once the middle class became disconnected with the ordinary people, and that disconnect went hand in hand with actually their emasculating political parties. The nationalist parties became mere shells, as Fanon would say, you know. And so the only organized force in the country remained the military, but the military itself was thoroughly colonial in its upbringing, in its mentality, in its every practice, in its officer ranks and everything. So it was very easy for the West to manipulate the same military to take over.
And some of the instruments of that Western manipulation, Ngugi, in this book, Wizard of the Crow, and in real life, is the World Bank, which in veiled, very thinly veiled description here is the Global Bank. And so you have, or maybe it's the IMF too, all rolled into one. So you have that institution of corporate globalization or imperialism, if you will, in this book. And with that, you have the American ambassador who makes
a prominent
cameo appearance here.
Actually, the landscape of the novel, takes in Asia, in Africa, and some sections of the novel are set in America, like in New York, you know, and so on, you know. The way I look at it was that a dictatorship, East, West, European, African, is really a tragedy manifesting itself in comedy, you know. For instance, the ruler of the fictional territory of Afraria wants to build a house which reaches heaven, you know, marching to heaven, as he calls it, so he can be a neighbor to God, you know.
This is his own Leaning Tower of Babel.
Yes, he wants, in the morning he can say to God, "How are you, God, this morning? How did you sleep? You know, can you please give me advice on how to develop, you know, the economy of my own country?" But the problem is that in building this ambitious marching to heaven, he is dependent on a loan from the Global Bank and the Global Ministry of Finance. But this loan is to be paid back by the people of Afraria, who have to commit the children or their children or their children or their children, you know, to forever keep on paying back the debt, the principal, the interest, and all the financial services that go into servicing, you know, the debt. Yeah.
So you deal with a debt problem that a lot of countries in Africa and elsewhere in the world are suffering because of the grandiose, megalomaniac ideas of their dictators.
Yeah. I'm really actually thinking of the world we have come to through globalization, where really the whole world, you know, that's why I call it actually a global epic from Africa, because the issues it's dealing with, literally, you know, are problems that face each and every man and woman in the world today, African, Asian, or, you know, or European or American. By this I mean, when I look at the world of globalization, I see two very, very important gaps or rifts. One is the rift between a group of very wealthy Western nations, you know, but very few, and a majority of poor nations from Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And the gap between the two is growing every day. And yet the wealth of the few nations in the West is dependent on the resources, both natural and human, of the poor nations. But the other rift, equally important, is the rift between, within each nation. Within each nation, there's a big gap, again, between the wealthy few and the majority poor, and that gap is also increasing daily. So if you go to Los Angeles, the figure that meets you is the beggar and the homeless. You go to London, you know, the beggar and the homeless. In Johannesburg, the beggar and the homeless. In Nairobi, in Mumbai, everywhere. So that image of the beggar and the homeless come to define, is really an image of the globalized world in which we are living. And for me, the two rifts between nations and within nations, you know, are really the basis of the great instability we are finding in the world today. And yet when people talk about this instability, or they are more concerned on the cultural rifts, you know, or religious fundamentalism, which are fine, but they don't want to address the real foundations of some of these, you know, rifts.
And Gugi, how would you address those? I mean, how do you get to that? And also, is it possible for, you know, the people in the United States who aren't benefiting from the empire to ally their interests with the people who are suffering in the developing world?
The problem, the first thing is, of course, understanding the problem, because there's a lot of obscuring of the nature of the world in which we live today. I think in a lot of discussions there's glossing over the two rifts, and I think we need to understand the nature of the two rifts, and as for me, therefore the importance of novels like Wizard of the Crow, which are making people really understand, you know, that human relationships, love, emotions, and so on are affected also by that world, because even emotions like love and so on, you know, do not really exist or develop, you know, in a vacuum. When the world in which we live is so, when the world of, say, globalizing capital means, you know, destruction or pollution of the environment, for instance, you know, this must affect each and every one of us, you know. So understanding this becomes very, very important. And once again, you know, pollution, for instance, of our environment, which becomes an image also of the pollution of our spiritual selves, is one of the main themes also in Wizard of the Crow. So it's understanding the problem, then we can face it, you know. A surgeon can only come up with a solution if he correctly analyzes the problem.
And do you have an idea what kind of surgery the surgeon would apply?
Well, that's really, you know, every move that she brings. First of all, of course, if you look at there is always hope, because if you look at the world again, you know, there is there are two forces at work quite clearly. There's globalization, which literally means, you know, capital being able to freely move in and out of territories, nation states, and so on. You know, that's globalization. You know, which is meant to pollution the rifts which I'm talking about. But quite frankly, also there is also globalism. You know, that is the coming together, you know, of peoples from different parts of the world, you know. So it's not, in a way, the two things, globalization and globalism, you know, are tied in that one, in a sense, you know. Globalism also becomes an important, you know, counter force, you know. We can know what's happening. For an event happening in India will be known by, you know, other people, how, you know, in America and the other way around. When the World Trade Organization meets, say, in Seattle or other places, you know, the forces against its distortions of the economic relations between peoples, or its policing those inequalities, you know, it's those forces opposing that are also able to gather and organize and gather in Seattle or other places, you know.
You've been listening to Gugi Wa-Tiong'o, the author of, most recently, Wizard of the Crow, and prior to that, A Grain of Wheat and Petals of Blood. Another theme, after we leave this theme of corporate globalization, or what you call a kind of a combination of colonialism,
corporonialism.
Another theme in this novel is the importance of women's liberation, the importance of a feminist consciousness, if you will, and that's been in some of your previous books as well. How did you come about your own kind of consciousness of this?
Yeah, in the first, of course, women have played a very, very important role in Kenyan and African history. Women have been very important in my own life and development, including my mother, who sent me to school, although she herself could not read, you know, or write. And that's why, by the way, the novel is dedicated to the memory of my mother, Wanjiku Wangugi. You know, but the difference in this book and my previous books, where I also feature fairly strong women, is women here have greater agency. Not only do they participate in the practice of changing, but they're also there out in front in mapping out strategies and tactics.
The leading revolutionary, Nyawira,
is Nyawira for reasons, you know. But even the women who are not necessarily progressive in the novel, because I have a whole range of women, some who work with the regime and are equally manipulating, but there is agency in their actions, you know. So it's the agency part, you know, of the women's consciousness, which is much stronger in this novel than it was in my previous, you know, narratives. You know, and the question of, you know, quite frankly, what they're struggling for, people like Nyawira, or the mine hero, or the other one, the committee, her male friend, they're struggling for a world where there is greater spirituality, greater spiritual awareness, not in a religiously institutional form, but precisely because, you know, human life, what is important in human life is its spirituality. Our striving for an ethical, you know, existence, you know, but in history, any contemporary history, as we know, the tendency is for, or put it this way, all religions, whatever they are, try in their own way to capture the image of that spirituality. But the problem is the particularities of the images through which they see those elements of spirituality become, in their own practices, the spirituality. So instead of the rites which they have becoming a means of reaching to that spirituality. The rites themselves take over. They become the spirituality itself.
And then there's dominance
and
within
then,
those.
And then you find all these rites, this rite of this religion and these rites who begin fighting each other, claiming to be the universal, you know, ritual and so on. You know, but what they are striving for, really, is that human yearning and human strive for greater spiritual wealth and so on. And this is what the leading contenders in Wizard of the Crow are also, you know, struggling for. And in this sense, you know, the question of the voice and silence become very important in the novel, because the empowerment or disempowerment of the people in the world manifests itself in the loss of the voice. Yeah? So they struggle for the return of the voice to the working people. And towards the end of the novel, you remember the voices calling, saying, let them not kill our future, come not only from the fictional Afraria, but usually these voices seem to merge with other voices all over the world, all of them crying, let them not kill our future. Let them not kill hope.
I'm speaking with Gugi Wachongo about his latest novel, Wizard of the Crow, and you do give voice to the dispossessed and to women, and especially a woman who isn't the strongest character at the beginning, who is a victim of wife beating, which you write about as being epidemic. It's epidemic here in the United States as well, and yet she is able to get voice and force her husband to stop doing that. Tell me about some other issues that you deal with in this book. You deal also with the plague of AIDS, with the virus there.
Yeah, you know, the AIDS, you know, is obviously, this is once again, you know, affecting the whole of Africa, you know, the whole world, not just Africa, quite frankly, although Africa is hit hard because the drugs are not always available, you know, and when they are available, they are very, very, you know, expensive and so on. Sometimes the governments themselves do not stress enough, you know, about, you know, AIDS awareness and so on, you know. So in the novel, anyway, I have tried to touch on that, you know, particular issue, because it's a fact of our contemporary, you know, existence and so on, you know. And once again, it's to do with the empowerment, you know, of the, you know, of the people. There's a section in the novel where one of the characters, you know, Kamete, goes back to the village, you know, his village, and he's talking after being absent for many years. And when he's walking around the village, whenever he asks about so-and-so, he has shown their grave. What about it? So the children of his youth, friends of his youth, you know, schoolmates and so on, you know, he finds them all, you know, buried, you know, around, you know, the village, you know, very, you know, devastating, yeah. So the question was that kind of awareness, you know. But once again, it's a question of empowerment, you know, of the people, so they are able to control their lives, you know, positively. You know.
And then in a cultural way, this was reminiscent to me of Frantz Fanon or Toni Morrison in The Bluest Eye, mm-hmm. for instance. You have a character who suffers from an acute case of a white ache, you write. The person becomes inarticulate. The person can only say two words, if and if only, and the if only was, if only I were white. To what extent is that that great desire to assimilate into whiteness still prevalent?
Yeah, it's obviously, I'm using the word whiteness as an image of international, in a sense, of bourgeoisie, because quite clearly this person who suffers from white ache, as you people suffer from stomachache, headache. He suffers from white ache. The kind of whiteness he wants to identify with is not, say, you know, working white. Is not, you know, he's a very clear idea of the kind of whiteness he wants to identify with, you know, and that is the rich and the powerful, the corporate white, if you like, you know. That's white he wants to become. Not the white of the homeless, not the white of the beggar, not the white of the working man and woman in the factory or in the fields and so on, you know. So it's very clear that he's also talking about the greed for same kind of greed that, you know, drives, you know, corporate power in the world. Yeah.
We only have about 3 minutes left. I wanted just to talk briefly, Gugi Wa Thiong'o, author of the novel Wizard of the Crow, about the importance of art or the role of art. You have written previously that art precedes the formation of the state, which I think is a great line. But you've also warned about art that's corrupted by the state. What role do you see a novel like Wizard of the Crow playing?
First of all, art, generally, you know, novels and so on, you know, or all forms of art, shall I say, you know, they, or put it this way, art is the food of imagination, you know. No society, human imagination is central to what it is to be human. Before we are able to build houses, to imagine our future, imagination plays the most important role in our lives, you know. And so literature, art, you know, which obviously, you know, feeds the imagination, is very, very important in all our lives, you know. And this is common in all historical phases of our being, you know. Even the people who live in the caves drew pictures or drawings on caves, you know. They told stories, you know. They sang because it's the food of the imagination, which is integral to their own total, you know, development, economic, political, cultural.
And you've tried to make it as accessible as possible, your own art, by writing not in English originally.
Yes, obviously, this was another, you know, big fight I've been having, because the majority of African intellectuals have been writing in English and French and Portuguese, when this knowledge is most needed by ordinary African peoples and so on, you know. But we have this big anomaly in the world where African intellectuals intellectualize in English and French. So their knowledge, even when it's very, very progressive and pro-people, but nevertheless is told in the storages, in the prison houses of European languages, you know. So my writing in Gikuyu language, my mother tongue, is to show that we need to empower those marginalized languages. And by the way, they're not only in Africa. You get the question of marginalized languages, again, is a global problem, you know, in Africa, in Asia. In America here, there's a question of Native Americans, you know. Their languages were also marginalized, you know. So they're not part of their self-empowerment. And we need those knowledges in those languages to empower peoples of Africa, peoples of Asia, Native Americans, and some European peoples, yeah.
We're going to have to end on that. We need to escape the prison houses of the European languages. Yeah. Gugi Wa Thiong'o, thanks so much for being my guest.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.